This episode is brought to you by Apeel. Apeel is a plant-based protective layer that helps produce last up to twice as long. Learn more at Apeel.com. Good evening and welcome to Eating Matters on Heritage Radio Network, where we talk about food systems and policy and how they impact all of us. I'm your host, Jenna Liute, and I'm so excited to be joined once again by my fellow Eating Matters colleague, Amber Chung, who will be co-hosting this episode with me. Today, we're speaking with Native food practitioner Nephi Craig, who is the founder of both the Native American Culinary Association as well as Cafe Gojo, where he's also the executive chef. Chef Craig is a central subject of Gather, a documentary that follows Indigenous nations' fight to restore their ancestral food systems. After our episode last week with Gather's director, Sanjay Rawal, we're grateful for the chance to dive deeper into food sovereignty, present-day colonial violence, and Chef Craig's various projects to increase the visibility of Native foods. Chef, welcome to Eating Matters.
Thank you very much for having me.
We're so thrilled you're able to come on the show today. So, and what made you want to become a chef in the first place? How did you get your start in the field?
When I was a young kid, I always had been baking with my mom. We were real poor in the 80s, so we would bake cookies and brownies, and I would bag them up and sell them in my on the street in my neighborhood. And that's how I earned a little extra cash and, you know, helped to buy groceries or whatever it might have been. But my grandfather, Joseph Carly Ivins, he was at the Carlisle Indian School in Pennsylvania, and on his trip back, he stayed in Anadarko, Oklahoma, at another boarding school and picked up some agricultural techniques from one of those assimilation schools out there. And he brought that home to when he made it back in his adult life to the Apache tribe and started a garden to supplement the table. So this is early 80s. That's some of my earliest memories are being in that big garden. So it was a part of my life early on. And I just kept cooking, and it evolved into grilling and pasta dishes and stuff like that throughout adolescence and in high school. I didn't know really what I wanted to do after high school. I honestly didn't even take my SATs in high school. I was a smart kid, but I just didn't apply myself. I was more into art and science and English and skateboarding. So I was it's kind of forced to make a decision, and I just looked at it real logically. Like, I wanted to do something in one of those fields I mentioned, but I didn't feel like I had the ability to get into university. So I just said, all right, what have I been doing the longest? And I just kind of felt it was cooking. And I had been watching Great Chefs of the World on the Discovery Channel in the 90s. So that was my only introduction to chef life, I guess. So I just went for it and dove right in, and it changed my life.
Yeah. And you went to culinary school, right?
Yeah, I went to a small cooking school in Scottsdale, Arizona at the Scottsdale Community College. I was very fortunate. I didn't know anything about the food industry. I didn't know anything about hospitality as a profession or an industry. But I just knew from my basic experience that we should be working also, or we should at least have some industry experience before going to school. So before school started, I was job searching, and I actually was lucky enough. I landed a job at a place called the Country Club at DC Ranch, working for Chef Chris Olson. And, you know, as an 18-year-old kid, I had no idea the caliber of the chefs I was working with. I just figured all kitchen jobs were kind of like that. But they were really well-traveled and very disciplined and organized, and they did a majority of the stuff from scratch. So I was working full time at night and going to school full time in the day. So one day's theory, one on the other side's ass kicking at night, you know, on the line. So it was pretty rad in that way.
And so now you're involved with several organizations. Can you tell us about the Native American Culinary Association, the Rainbow Treatment Center, and Cafe Gojo, and what common thread ties these different projects together?
Yeah, thank you for that. The Native American Culinary Association is a network of individuals that I founded you know, kind of officially like in 2000, in the year 2000, went public with it then. But it had been a concept that I had been, that just kind of started as a seed of observation when I was in school, when I was 18 years old. Right away, there was no representation of Native peoples in this curriculum about world cuisine. There was mention of Mesoamerica with chocolate and chilies and maybe potatoes in South America, but nothing about the this Native food universe I mentioned earlier about the tribes in North America or the tribe that I was from, the tribes that I was from. So I felt like early on as a kid, I was like, a lot of the chefs in the school and people around me, they described that you could become a master chef someday, that you could master this. And the only other areas that I had heard that used really was in music or fine art or martial arts. So I thought it was pretty cool that, you know, the idea of becoming a master cook someday, that's kind of what I was like, all right, I'm going to give my life to this. And so I started Naka in a kind of a concept because there was no representation that I could see in 98. And I figured in, you know, 15, 10, 20 years, whatever amount of time, I'm still going to be doing this. So by that time, I'll be able to mentor others like the mentorship I need now. So that's how that started. It was essentially to network and find other emerging chefs and established chefs, people like me that felt lost in this food universe. I feel like as Native peoples that are in this field, we know for a fact that there's others like us out there. And that was just my intuition. And we had our first gathering in 2003 at Mesa Community College. It was a free event. We drew over like 200 people in the city. And then we kind of went underground for a number of years. And just not until 2011 or 2012, I believe, we had a conference at our ski resort where by then I had become an executive chef. And then we followed that up a year and a half later in 2013 with a large event in Tucson. And since then, we've kind of gone a little bit underground. It's not an official kind of organization, per se. We wanted it to be a network. And most of the gatherings that we put together, it was really to gather in the spirit of ceremony, the way we gather for ceremony and rituals in our tribes. We're only propelled by those that believe in it. And that's kind of the spirit of Naka. So we'll be planning to do something again in the near future. Over my period of time, I've been working for the Rainbow Treatment Center for 4 years now. And this was an evolution of my work. Prior to going to the Rainbow Treatment Center, I was just in the general hospitality industry. And I had always felt and known from my own personal experience that there was this really powerful component within Native foods that could be tapped into as cooks and chefs and community members. So I somehow along the way, I wanted to use that. And as you saw in the film Gather, my life is I have a trail of ups and downs because of substance abuse. All along the way, this Native foods were there to kind of help me to rebuild my life in every pitfalls, per se. So it just so happened that after about 9 years at the Sunrise Park Resort, it's the ski resort that I was formerly the executive chef of. It was a 90-room hotel that our tribe owns and operates. That whole team was White Mountain Apaches. So it was so awesome after traveling around the world and coast to coast in America, landing back home in 2007 or 8, and being really different that chef's position there. That is what evolved the most meaningful relationships and connection to time and place. So so now I've left that industry, didn't leave the industry. It's kind of a blend now. So the treatment center is our community's drug and alcohol treatment center. And I'm the coordinator of the nutritional recovery program, and Café Gojon exists inside that program. So Café Gojon is a response to historical trauma in that we want just to boil all the jargon down, just to keep Native foods insight in mind. I feel like when we can do that simple action, so much more will come from it. So that's kind of a, in a nutshell, path right to Cafe Gojo.
Thank you so much for sharing all that. And how did you come to be involved in the film Gather?
By the time you meet me in Gather, I'm already like 21 years into my path as a professional cook. I feel like in the American Southwest, the concept of NACA and my utilization of social media as a tool from 2011 through 2000, say 2016 maybe, that kind of is like a broadcasting from the mountains right to the world through the internet. And that experience of being at Sunrise Park Resort, we were in a very old hotel. We didn't have a big food budget. It wasn't fine dining. It was nothing like some of the amazing operations I'd been in around the world in America. So I had to turn off the blinders, or I had to turn off the blinders as a chef and just focus on what we had absolute control over, and that was our minds as a team and the skills we build. So I began to do a blog called Apaches in the Kitchen. And that blog detailed some of our path, and it began to get notoriety. And then as Facebook was more popular, just the articulation of the food experience is what I feel allowed me and my team to get some notoriety. And then the combination of the conferences we were doing, just really being advocates for the voices that I feel we felt that were in the foods. So when they were scouting for Gather, I guess I was one of the most visible in the field in the American Southwest, I suppose. Mm-hmm. And so they approached me, and initially I was very hesitant to be a part of it because I have experience in film production, and I know that as an Indigenous person, sometimes film crews come into our communities only to appropriate and only to quote unquote discover or to Columbus us, you know what I mean? Like, or to rescue us. That kind of perspective is not what I wanted to be involved with. And I really was adamant that our audience be for Native peoples and that we really capture this part of this human struggle before all the romantic notions of being Native. So I agreed, and that's how we began moving along with the production of Gather.
And cultural appropriation is something that certainly we're going to talk about a little bit later in the episode. So stay tuned more on that front. But with regard to the characters in Gather, each are engaged in food sovereignty in various ways, in different, you know, ways through their, you know, looking at their own unique food system through lenses of education, environmentalism, biochemistry, so on. How do you define food sovereignty in the context of the White Mountain Apache tribe, and how do you see your role within that?
That's a very good question, and I feel like we're very fortunate as White Mountain Apaches in a larger context of Native American tribes in the United States, in that us as White Mountain Apaches, we're located in our ancestral landscape where our people have been living and thriving longer than the United States has been a country. We've been in these mountains for thousands of years. And so we've got this deep relationship and history here. And so we've still got access to pieces of the puzzle of our ancestral health. So food sovereignty, if you can imagine the health of a people or the culture or the language as a large mirror that reflects who we are, conquest and colonization caused this mirror to be dropped and shattered. And we're fortunate that we're still in our ancestral landscape and the pieces of that mirror are still within reach. So we still have elements that made us who we are as Apaches. Basically, all tribes, or for us in particular, we became White Mountain Apaches by interacting with our White Mountain Apache landscape. So the animals, the foods, the waters, the climate, the soil taught us who we are. And that's why food is so connected to our identity. And so with themes of colonization and historical trauma and contemporary colonial violence, I feel like once we put Native Foods Insight in mind, a lot of that genetic reconnection will occur, whether it's consciously or subconsciously. So in that way, where we have an advantage, but we're also disadvantaged because we're a marginalized community. All the social ills of most reservations are common with us. So for me, food sovereignty is a spiritual and psychological endeavor that begins with a really profound paradigm shift around food and its connection to our core. It's way more than tactile, just cooking. I feel like if we can promote a food paradigm shift that will allow us to reconnect in a humble way, we will grow more farmers, fishers, cooks and medicine people and herbalists and all those things that are tied to food. So that's how I feel our story of food sovereignty is hopefully continuing to play out. Is that we're just gradually on this path to reconnecting ourselves to our identity and our landscape. And as a note too, this is, that's just based on my personal realization. It's caused me as I've gotten a little older to be more humble with my advocacy, because I know that on a larger scale, many Indigenous peoples and Native American people are existing in metropolitan areas that don't have access to land. And that's almost like a culinary diaspora where knowledge is displaced and floating and unknown. So we're very fortunate in our region, but we still have many, many, many obstacles.
So with all of that said, how have you seen or how can you imagine Café Gojou and the People's Farm opening up new possibilities for this community in terms of economic opportunity or political autonomy?
The farm in particular, in Ndebikia, which translates to the people farm, the people's farm, they've been at this work about 8 years now, and it's been an uphill battle since their inception. There's the stereotypical notion of the violent warrior Apache, and that narrative was created by colonizers about us, not by us, when the true reality is that we're very highly intelligent, strategic agriculturalists or even farmers, and are one of our main crops throughout history is corn. And so we've got this long tradition, and the farm has kind of been battling that stereotype, especially when it comes to at-risk youth or men in our community, because we kind of believe the narrative of the violent warrior Apache. I mean, just Google Apache, Apache warrior or Apache man, and you'll get tons of images of some weird-looking Italian guy with a wig jumping off a cliff with a knife, you know, in a vest, you know.
Yeah. It's true. It is true. Like in movies and stuff. Sorry.
Yeah. You know, so that narrative is there and they're battling that. And, but they've been very vigilant and diligent about their work. They understand the connection of time and place to the roots and the soil. And they're my personal hometown heroes for real. We both have this common value. We have the common values that food sovereignty is critical to our future. It's a source of our creativity, our spirit, fun and family and culture and respect and hard work. You know, ultimately, I think we kind of both feel that that agriculture and cooking demystify the hard work that comes, demystifies farming and all these other food buzzwords that are going on right now. You get deep in the work, it's no longer mystical and mysterious. It's production, it's hard work, and it really shows who we are in terms of our work ethic. So in a real simple way, we hope that, like I said, Native Foods Insight in mind. For the cafe, I feel like I'm not a native food expert, even though I've got tons of experience with it. I feel like I hope that I can be a facilitator in the cafe where we use our base knowledge to prepare some of these ingredients, and the real experts in the community that have much longer relationships with the food and the language can help to educate us and our families. And I hope that it provides a paradigm shift that just demonstrates some of the vast possibilities with Native foods that can lead into some of those economic, political, and policy needs and issues.
I've heard you speak about the three sisters of Native American cuisine in the past. Could you tell us what these are and what the cultural significance is?
The three sisters are three very important cultivars: corn, beans, and squash. And this is, to me, this is like a threshold dish for indigenous food and cooking. I'll give you an example really quick, is that in my community, I never even heard of a dish called Three Sisters growing up. It wasn't until I was much deeper into my professional cooking path and did a lot of traveling, especially back east, where I began to hear about Three Sisters. But those three ingredients were always visible in my life on the Apache tribe and on the Navajo Nation. And learning about the companion planting aspect and the nutritional aspect, where corn, beans, and squash together produce a protein, I feel like that can be taught to all ages. It can be a kindergarten garden class. It can be a middle school, high school educational session. And it can be taught to, you know, PhD, doctorate level nutritionists and scientists for the ecological components of companion planting. So it's a really powerful example, yet it's so simple, you know, equal parts corn, right, equal parts beans, equal parts squash. And that demonstrates the ancestral intelligence, not only just through agriculture, but cosmologically, nutritionally, and culturally. So it's a really powerful combination. I like doing it. You know, it's really cool.
Yeah, and delicious.
Yeah, yep.
And it's really delicious.
It's its own universe, because imagine, you know, maybe one of the listeners can do the math, like how many cultivars, how many types of beans, how many types of squash, how many types of corn, how many ways to prepare it, how many seasons. Multiply that, you probably got millions of combinations.
And in the beginning of Gather, you articulate one of the central themes of the whole film when you say that colonial violence has never gone away. In addition to the negative and damaging stereotypes that you just mentioned, are there particular forms of colonial violence that you see the White Mountain Apache community contending with today?
Yeah, it's it's almost like every reservation is almost like a microcosm of each other. Because of the health disparities that we face and we contend with on a regular basis, themes of, you know, suicidality, the addiction, the DV, the incarceration, and the education levels, reservations, and just kind of from an economic standpoint and business standpoint, the whole system is set up to keep really set up with the illusion of sovereignty. It's very difficult for anyone to open a business on a reservation because there's no value of the land. All this land is federal trust land, and you can't get a bank loan to open a business. And many corporations are very hesitant to come and set up shop, or just businesses in general. It took us, a couple decades to get, you know, a fast food joint in our reservation, you know, and they dangle the notion of a sovereign Indian nation in front of us, and we have the ability to leverage that, but at its core, we're still under the control of the colonial oppressors and powers, and so many of those colonial values and ideals, they clash with indigenous values and ideals, and the erasure of identity and culture and access to land and food compounds those ills. So imagine the intergenerational complex grief and unresolved grief that's passed on in parenting roles from the 50s, when a lot of our parents were in boarding schools, or a lot of our parents were shamed for speaking their languages or practicing their culture. Imagine growing up seeing yourself as a caricature in the American eye when a television is beginning to become very popular. And so you have this complex relationship with your own identity across Native America. So that turns into frustration, that turns into guilt, and ultimately it begins to manifest as all of those forms of violence, whether it's interpersonal, lateral, structural. There's so much weight on top of us that we cannot see, and it's difficult to help our people to recognize some of those themes. So colonial violence is like a shape-shifting disease. It's this really cunning and deceptive trickster monster, you know, in our communities.
Wow, I never thought of it like that. That's such a helpful explanation. What about misconceptions about Apache cuisine or Native food specifically? Is there anything you would like us to, you know, be aware of, and what are the consequences of perpetuating those misconceptions?
Well, one of the biggest misconceptions about Native American cuisine is that it doesn't exist. You know, it's like,
that's a big one.
Yeah.
I'd say that's a big one.
it's huge. I mean, and also with all these contemporary words and descriptions that we're swimming in right now, from being correct and politically correct and meeting people where they're at and being able to describe our indigenous experience. Some people have believe they have the privilege to say, I'm doing a cooking demonstration where I'm using a locally sourced and hunted venison loin, and I'm roasting it in a pan, and I decide to go ahead and add some butter and baste this ingredient, maybe with some thyme. I'll complete the dish and I'll plate it up, and afterwards, or even during the session, someone, a non-native, would interject and say, well, you're using butter and thyme. Aren't those European ingredients? So you're not necessarily doing Native foods. And that's one of the most privileged and damaging statements that I've come across many, many times from all ages and all professions of non-natives. And even some of our own people will take that stance. And my response to that, usually I let it pass, and I just, you know, I don't get all upset about it. But in all truth, the same thing goes for Western cuisines, like, say, the dish ratatouille. That dish is almost all Native foods. I mean, tomatoes, squash, zucchini, yellow squash, those are all indigenous cultivars. Asian cuisines, all the chilies and hot, spicy dishes that were impossible before 1500 without the introduction of the chili. Chocolate and Swiss chocolatiers, you know, they're not doing their, you know, Swiss cuisine or French cuisine or whatever cuisine they might be. They're using Native foods. So Americans have been utilizing and practicing indigenous cuisine since they landed and since the beginning of the United States. So it's maybe to sum that all up, is that all of contemporary American cuisine, the foundational terroir of that is indigenous foodways.
Absolutely. Okay. So this is very helpful for me, because it is certainly a learning experience. And I certainly want to apologize in advance if I ask anything that would be offensive. And I hope, you know, please help me understand if I ever do, because that's the point in being able to talk to somebody as amazing as you to help all of us understand. So I think this kind of speaks to appropriation, which we, you know, touched on earlier, right? I'm wondering, this wasn't so much a focal point in Gather, but how do you define cultural appropriation? And what does this term look like in the world of food?
Cultural appropriation to me means that any individual that is in a position of privilege that is utilizing ancestral knowledge or traditional ecological knowledge of indigenous peoples, I think there's a global definition of that. And then there's also like a North American or United States definition of that. And there's a micro-regional definition of that, definitely.
Perfect.
So my kind of, yeah, right. Like,
yeah,
we, it'd be difficult to make some of the similar arguments about indigenous food appropriation in, say, Europe. I mean, in some way, because there's not a high population of Native people suffering from the colonialism of U.S. imperialism. Right. So it's a little bit different kind of way to weave it together in defense of our foodways and traditional ecological knowledge. But I think when an individual or an organization is in a position of privilege to have the resources to monetize traditional ecological knowledge without acknowledging that there has to be more than just acknowledging the roots of this scientific and medicinal and intellectual knowledge that our ancestors have contributed. I think it comes down to power dynamics. How can people that are in a position of power, if they're going to deliberately or indirectly appropriate this knowledge and turn it into more resources or money, how can they engage in a meaningful relationship to help shift power dynamics to those people where the knowledge comes from? We've seen that happen. I mean, the damage is that, how can I phrase it? The world has been, tomatoes, chocolate, and chilies, those three examples, they have become billion-dollar mm-hmm. industries with, you know, and those crops are taken out of the communities that they come from. And very rarely is the history acknowledged. Acknowledgement isn't enough in 2020 and moving into 2021. There has to be action behind it. And I think that's the next evolution in this food phenomenon that we're experiencing. If listeners can understand that just a land acknowledgement is not enough, acknowledging the roots is not enough. There has to be some intelligent action behind that to get to the root of power dynamics to help people, native peoples or people of color, empower themselves to monetize or turn that knowledge into resources. So that's kind of the best way I can kind of describe that to hit all three of those points. You know what I mean?
Yeah. No, that's brilliant. So what would an example be of intelligent action that can be taken?
Well, I think a lot of food producers take the first step of action. They'll go and travel to the regions where, say, maybe coffee is produced or cocoa beans are grown, or where a certain variety of corn is grown. And that's like the first step of action. But sometimes where a lot of food producers and indigenous food appropriators, that's where it stops. That's the beginning. That's the first step of action to monetize the ancestral knowledge. But what they did not do, what I'm assuming most do not do, is that building meaningful relationships with the people on the ground, being really community based. And again, shifting much of that, much of the resources back into the community. So I think it comes to meaningful relationships that are not one-sided. I think if food producers or companies are going to begin building relationships with indigenous communities that produce whatever resource it might be, there has to be those shared values of honest portrayals of our histories of colonialism, public health, epidemiology, and resource extraction that they are not going to be damaging as much as possible. You know what I mean? I feel like that's some deep action right there. And it takes a long time to do that, I think.
Yeah, absolutely. And so I want to get back to your example about ratatouille because it uses native ingredients.
Yeah, that dish was really popularized by the cartoon, right? The Pixar cartoon, which is one of the best movies ever. So
ever. Please don't say anything. Real. I hope you like that movie. I love that movie.
It's so rad because, you know, Tony Bourdain and Thomas Keller consulted on that, you know, but that's a good reference point in a lot of my classes, you know, the food memory aspect, the neurological connection to food memories. I always reference mm-hmm. that, but indigenous cultivars changed just about every cuisine in the world. Squash, chilies, tomatoes, they made it to Europe only after 1500, and they began to thrive because of the climate. And they're renamed and basically woven into the fabric of that gastronomical history. And with little to no representation, but with little to no, acknowledgement. Maybe they're just called New World ingredients or whatever. But it's kind of that two-way street. Like, you can't call my dish that has lemon juice and maybe a red wine vinegar for the acidity, or using butter. Mm-hmm. You can't call my stuff not native indigenous cuisine because I'm using Asiatic or European ingredients. It's not deniable that ratatouille is not a classic peasant dish or a food of poverty or food of farmers. But in fact, the indigenous cultivars, it would not be a part of their culinary history had it not been appropriated through colonial violence and very violent means. So that really needs to be told. And then also for us as Native food practitioners, I feel like we have to be empowered enough to say the same thing when we see those cuisines. Sometimes we're really kind of there's almost this as a chef. It's almost as a chef and a person of color. You kind of feel like you're dominated by this this huge gastronomical guard, right? This old classical system, and you can't really mess with it. And when you're out in a metropolitan area where you're like the only Native in a kitchen, or your sanity seems like insanity when you bring it up from a culinary standpoint, you know? And, mm-hmm. you know, let's add to that the toxic but changing culture of kitchens, you know, it's shifting right now. You know, most of the time as a young cook, I brought it up and, you know, I got made fun of or people talk shit and do whatever, you know? So I think it's really valuable that Native peoples feel empowered to speak on their food history. And that's kind of how I can best describe how ratatouille is a good example of that. And there's many, many other dishes that use corn, beans, squash, chilies across Eurasia.
So it seems to me, if I'm understanding this, appropriation is really when you're benefiting, when one population that is of power, has more power, is benefiting from another's, you know, financially benefiting from another's traditions. I think with, you know, with food, it gets, for me, I love learning about different cultures through their foods that they cook. And so when we think about appropriation, it's not appreciation or, you know, the home cook experimenting with different flavor profiles or whatnot. It is this like financial benefit and kind of like claiming as one's own. Did I understand that correctly?
Yeah, I definitely think that's the biggest chunk of the damaging aspect of cultural appropriation. But it can also be damaging for, you know, the home user too, just if they're not really fully acknowledging the struggle and the plight and the strength of Indigenous peoples moving forward. I think if people over romanticize Native American cuisine and cooking, it's just like many conversations around cuisines of Mexico. You know, people, you've heard the sentiment before where people say Americans love Mexican food but hate Mexican people. The same thing is true. The same thing is true for Indigenous cuisines. The romance, the intelligence, and the sophistication, you know, dominant society loves that about Native Americans, but they forget and they will not really want to hear our voices because we speak truth when it comes to these issues. So, I feel like just knowing the history and doing the research and the study, whether it's commercially or personally, really tapping into and realizing that many of the roots of the foods and ingredients that we're using, the people are still in those territories or they're still around. So be conscious of that and help to, you know, locate practitioners of that region and support their work, you know. Because there is a ton of profound resilience among Native peoples and people of color today.
Okay, we are going to take a really quick commercial break right here, but don't go far because we'll be right back. This episode is brought to you by Appeal. Here at HRN, we care about reducing waste across our food system, from farms to home kitchens. We know that about half the produce we grow ends up in the trash. We all want to enjoy produce at peak freshness and reduce the amount that gets thrown away. That's where Appeal comes in. Appeal is a plant-based protective layer that helps produce last up to twice as long. It's edible, invisible, and imitates how peels naturally protect fruits and vegetables. Because here's the thing, less waste doesn't just mean we're throwing less food away. It also means we waste less water, energy, and other resources that go into growing produce. Appeal works with nature to reduce waste across the food system, from the farm to the kitchen. Appeal helps us conserve our precious resources to ensure we have fresh food to meet our growing need. Appeal, food gone good. Learn more at appeal.com.
And we're back on Eating Matters, where today we're speaking with Chef Nephi Craig, Native food practitioner and founder of Cafe Gojo.
On the theme of people being more conscious or helping people to become more conscious. I read a past interview of yours in which you spoke about a mainstream westernized restaurant culture that prioritizes pleasure in the dining experience and sort of sidesteps serious conversations about food and where it comes from or its history. How do you see the experiences that you curate as a chef diverging from this westernized way of eating? And why is it important to have food be about more than just pleasure?
I think from a monetary and business and economic standpoint, the food culture will from a point of necessity needs to focus on the luxury and the experience of having a good time with your family members. I think in American culture and other cultures around the world that, or restaurant cultures, basically, that have the ability to go dine in and hang out and have a good time. I think the expectation is that it's going to be a fun, happy time and you're going to forget about your issues and it's an escape, really. So maybe the transition into educating or providing a more clear description of the cuisines of the world, I think it's a dual process. I think it can happen in restaurants, and it also should definitely be happening at home. I feel like restaurants are just a tip of the iceberg for food culture. I really hope that the pressures of this pandemic cause people to really re-examine our food choices, where our food comes from, who's cooking our food, and what conditions they have to thrive under in order just to put the food on a plate in a restaurant setting. So I really think that this ancestral strength can be articulated in the dining experience. But the diner that's going to come in needs to be aware of that ahead of time, and open and receptive to those themes. I saw that happen while I was at the Sunrise Park Resort Hotel. We ran a chef's table, and it would be, anywhere from 6 to 12 to 15 courses of, it was like a culinary journey through North and South America in our kitchen, using only indigenous foods. And, it was just kind of a neat way to reconnect with diners. And it was very, very powerful. It was very powerful for some of the people that came in. Some people felt that they could never have seen native foods produced like that. And some of our elders and community members even shed tears or were compelled to say prayers while they were at our tables. So it was very emotional and intimate. And I feel like that's why much of this work, food work that we're going to do collectively, is an intimate journey and it impacts a larger collective. So I hope that answered that a little bit.
Absolutely. And in addition to that, this is something you do talk about in the film, you explore the use of native foods as an intervention for other health challenges, and also addiction specifically, which is clearly a different approach than more like westernized medicines or recovery programs. Can you tell us about this just in general and how you personally benefited from this approach?
Certainly. The root of that conversation is that I've lived it. It's lived experience. And with as much humility and respect for other people's journeys that are still suffering independent chemical dependency or addiction, and those that have survived it. I really felt all along my journey, from my time in Japan to my time in London and Germany and in Brazil and New York and wherever I was in the world, that the food had the ability to heal and to be this powerful element of a person's support system. The food isn't going to specifically the one root of someone's salvation. It's a very powerful layering or a very dynamic thread in the tapestry for sure. And so my path began as, just a young impressionable cook wanting to do a 3-star Michelin restaurant with native foods. And it evolved over time with many of the struggles living in America and around the world and working around the world. And seeing, not knowing that I was deep in a colonial mindset in professional kitchens, and I was deep in a colonial mindset by using chemicals and alcohol and drugs. And so, and I never really thought that I could get clean on my reservation. I felt like I had to leave or find it somewhere else. But I finally was able to, as a result of loss and many other elements, you know, I lost my father in 2011. He passed away from cancer, and he was one of my biggest supporters for me to become a chef and to get my life together, you know, to get clean, because he was in sobriety too. And so the combination of getting clean after suffering a lot, the loss of my father, and being in our ancestral landscape and working at the Sunrise Park Resort Hotel with very minimal resources, but finding that we could tap into our cultural strength, that was a turning point. And since then, it's evolved into this combination for me as one individual, where kind of I said I kind of almost left the hospitality, or maybe I'm blending the two, the hospitality and the therapeutic, because today I'm an advanced certified relapse prevention specialist and a behavioral health technician. So I'm a clinician along with a chef, you know? So I feel like so much of indigenous foodways, so much of kitchen culture is behavioral, and the group dynamics and the behavioral health aspect has been there all along. And in recovery and in healing, not just drugs and alcohol, talking about, you know, someone recovering from a stroke or someone recovering from a heart attack or getting a pre-diabetic diagnosis or any other disease or sickness, much of the healing is going to be in the behaviors. So when for the therapeutic realm that I've kind of shifted into is the combination of the food, the nutrition, and the behavioral components of foraging, farming, cooking, group dynamics. And then also this the one of the most important pieces is the spiritual nutrition that comes from learning this food history, this empowering element of realizing our power. And so to me, that's what's really exciting about the future, at least of my own practice of native food and cooking, is that I feel like I'm evolving in a way that I could not have predicted, but the root of it is surviving addiction and trying to find a more humble way to live out decolonization and embrace the rest of my life through a lens of indigeneity and intelligent coexistence. And that's my hope for others. I know my story is very different from many other chefs and native chefs. But the common themes of the industry, we basically survive, because many of us as chefs, we realize the toxicity, but we just can't pinpoint some of the angst and hurt and frustration. And I feel like maybe the pandemic and the loss of so many restaurants right now will help us to get to that point. And so if I can be of aid or assistance for others in that way, you know, I think I'm proficient in that, you know. I feel like it's going to be a very dynamic and interesting journey forward. And I feel like our Western Apache group and our humble old gas station cafe that we transformed into a kitchen will be pioneering that. So I'm really hopeful.
And you know, certainly there is right now, if we, you know, zoom out and look at like American life, you know, in general, there are a lot of people who are hurting. And even just with like addiction, we have like an opioid epidemic that is raging across this country. Is your approach something that can be extended to, you know, outside the kitchen and to other Americans struggling with addiction and other, you know, tremendous health challenges right now? And can this be done in a way that is not appropriation, per our earlier conversation?
Yes, it definitely can, because we're talking about the human experience of saving our own lives. And the guiding elements of this are some very core human principles, universal principles of human tenacity and survivance and spirituality. So I do feel like it's applicable for not just chefs and cooks and people in the food world, I feel like it's crucial to every family and every person around the world. And again, part of this equation of health and recovery is meeting people where they're at. Some people are just not ready to hear the truth about this food history, or might not even be ready to combine the therapeutic nature and culinary arts or cooking at home with this. But I think to simplify all of that information and all the quagmire of it all is to just really hopefully help people to look at cooking as a way to build your emotional intelligence and a way to engage in a very intimate form of self-care, not just for you, but whoever you're cooking for. And a lot of these themes, the topics we've covered, can be shared and talked about and perpetuated through food, the positive and empowering side. And we can also, because if we're gonna recover and heal as a society and as people and individuals, we've gotta address the negative and the positive of our life and what ails us. So I feel like since much of the food and the food, the force that's around food is psychological from a human aspect. The reason we love food and it's so powerful to us is because of our own intellectual articulation of the emotional experience and the spiritual experience. Without that, it's just, you know, it's just powerful cultivars in a field. And so we make it special because we believe it is. And I definitely hope that through this broadcast, I'm able to find other like-minded individuals that are able and willing to possibly, you know, do some work together, because I feel like we're onto something. And I say that in the most respectful way to all professionals that are in this field, because, you know, I've been doing it 20 years as a chef. But in terms of therapy culture, there's much way more advanced and articulate professionals in that field.
Okay, so we have time for just two more quick questions. And the first is, since this is, you know, a policy show, I would be remiss in not asking you about a policy question. So I'm wondering, especially as we've seen chefs become more involved in food system reform and food policy, I'm wondering if there are particular policies that you are interested or involved with that you would like others to know about or, you know, pay attention to?
My work has been community-based for the past 12, almost 13 years now. When I came back stateside after traveling and working abroad and began to be here in the United States again, I decided that if I'm going to do Native cuisine, I'm going to do it in Native territory in my ancestral landscape. So that's why I came home. It's kind of like that tradition of French chefs. If you wanted to get an old school 3 Michelin star restaurant in the you know 60s, 70s, and 80s, you had to go to the French countryside. And if you really want to get real good Vietnamese or Japanese food, you went to Vietnam or Japan. You know, same thing with what I want to do. And so, so much of the work has been focused on working to build other people, capacity building and expanding food knowledge and just keeping Native food insight in mind and demonstrating to our people that this is a pathway for some people, whether it's farming or cooking or foraging. And as that relates to policy, I feel like over that that span of over a decade, so much of the foundation has been laid, and I recognize that I'm tapping into very human elements, and I've been a part of this national conversation with Native foods for a while as well. And I feel like the creation of policies in Native communities is what's important. I think, as I mentioned earlier, the guise of sovereignty in Indian country, there's still some power in that that facade, I believe. We can still maximize our sovereignty as tribal nations in the United States, but it requires us to really examine and create the policies necessary to perpetuate food sovereignty. I really hope that, like the Navajo Nation has a junk food tax. There's other tribes that have initiated food policies that will enable them to utilize their fishing, hunting, and farming techniques, and also protect from cultural appropriation. There's the concept and the truth of the legal side of cultural intellectual property. Some of this is very, very important to our future as it relates to food sovereignty. So I definitely think to those that are listening, supporting indigenous food initiatives around land and water is very important. And again, this goes all the way back to power dynamics of, you know, allowing Native people to do the work they need to do instead of distributing resources or distributing shifting power with strings attached. That's a form of colonial violence. So we're really talking liberation of the mind, body, and spirit, and connecting that, using the oppressor's language, legal system, so that we can perpetuate our own work and decriminalize some of these acts of fishing, hunting, and farming, and trespassing on lands that are state owned, you know, when it's ancestral territory. So big, big conversation with food policy.
You mentioned the Navajo Nation junk food tax, which I want to follow up on. To provide context, this was an attempt by Navajo leaders to curb obesity rates, which are almost three times higher than the national average. And they did so by adding a 2% tax on junk food and soda. So this policy was met with a fair amount of resistance, I would say. Some people definitely saw it as punitive and something that would just make food even more expensive, especially in a community where there was also high unemployment. So I'm wondering, Chef, what was your take on this policy?
I think from a health and cook standpoint, as a community member standpoint, I personally feel like it was a very courageous move. And maybe kind of because I have a deep insight into food and cooking just as a practitioner, I feel like it was courageous because it really challenges people's eating habits. And eating mm-hmm. habits and food choices are very, very, very personal. You know, all the way down to how we crave food is, you know, the science of cravings, you know. So I feel like it set a precedent for most of Native America or all of Native America, because the Navajo Nation is the largest tribe in the United States. It's bigger than West Virginia or it's bigger than Virginia, I believe, and the highest population, yet it's still considered a food desert. I think there's only like 13, 14 grocery stores in all of this territory. So challenging the way we've been conditioned to eat, at least when it comes to something like junk food, was very courageous on their part. And I feel like much of the backlash from natives and non-natives could definitely be because of those eating habits that we've been conditioned to accept as a form of oppression. You know, our lack of our limited access to fresh foods and food knowledge in general. So I feel like there's much more work to be done. I feel like the Navajo Nation set a really powerful precedent for all of Native America. And hopefully we can see other foods like that, because I don't think food access or lack of access should be punitive. When we're talking food and nutrition for health and recovery from mental health disorders or disease, they say you never take people's food away. You just kind of allow people to make their own choices. So kind of with that in mind, it's like 50-50, you know, but it was something I feel had to be done because we're in a state of crisis in public health. It might not seem like it as an everyday person on the street, but the epidemic of diabetes and heart disease, it's mm-hmm. an epidemic. It's a reality.
Yeah, absolutely.
And then the last question, how can our listeners support your work beyond, as you said, shifting power with strings attached? And you mentioned this hope of connecting like-minded individuals in the culinary world. So if there are any among our listeners, how can they join you?
I think maybe just trying to reach out and see and, you know, start working to build ethical and smart relationships in terms of exchanging knowledge. I've delivered a lot of content just in this interview alone, and I feel like maintaining contact and supporting the work of not only myself but other practitioners. I have a unique flavor. I know because of all my years of experience, there are some chefs doing what I do in terms of combining the therapeutic with the culinary, and I feel like there's more work to be done in that way. But I'm also a chef that you know, is very technically based too. I enjoy the style of cooking of, you know, 1, 2, 3 Michelin starred restaurants. I like the technical aspect of fine dining. I like the skills of it. And I'm, in all reality, since I was 18 to now, I'm still on the journey to become a master one day. You know, I don't think I'm there, you know, but I feel like I'm on this path of self-mastery through food and cooking. And that, I feel like that's where I'm at. And it's kind of like I always, you know, I use movie analogies all the time. It's like Tulsa Doom and Conan the Barbarian. You know, I'm on the journey of the riddle of steel. You know, once upon a time, I thought it was all about the steel and the physical elements. But no, later on, it's about the psychological and spiritual elements of our own power, you know. So supporting the work is just, you know, basically reaching out and following hashtags, because much of the sentiment I'm communicating today is not represented in mass media. It's not in too many books right now. It's emerging in academia and other professions and health fields, but we're still a subculture of a subculture of a subculture in terms of advocacy and being represented. So when you can tap into the sentiment, and most of the sentiment is captured in social media, because everybody and their grandma has a phone. And they're putting out data on a regular basis. So I think support other native food practitioners. Those of us that were featured in the movie Gather, we're scratching the surface barely. And there are many, many more characters just like us on every single reservation in the United States and every single native community in Turtle Island. So doing your best to find those and support us. And check out my Instagram. that's one way to do it.
What is your Instagram?
My Instagram is just Nephi_Craig. And it's a fun space. I do cooking demonstrations every Wednesday. I call it my Wu-Tang Wednesday. and I, you know, I just did one the other night. So I've been going on 15 weeks. I'm trying to hit 36 chambers, 36 weeks.
All right.
That's amazing. But it's fun. And I think, As a closing remark and supporting the work, know that it's serious work, but don't take it too seriously. But have a really strong sense of professional ethics and personal ethics as you embark in this journey of support or doing the work yourself. And that's most vital, because as a practitioner, your health and mental health on this journey is paramount. You just have to be able to make good, healthy decisions along the way. So with that, have fun too. Be creative.
Okay, well, we're going to have to leave it there for today. This segment was co-produced with Amber Chong. Our show engineer is Jeet Paul, and the music is by Tim Archer. All episodes of Eating Matters are available on the HRN website or as a podcast wherever they're found. If you haven't done so already, please subscribe. I'm Jenna Liute, and thanks for listening.
Eating Matters is powered by Simplecast. Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. For our freshest content and to learn more about our 10-year anniversary celebration happening all year long, subscribe to our newsletter. Enter your email at the bottom of our website, heritageradionetwork.org. Connect with us on Instagram and Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can also find us at facebook.com/heritageradionetwork. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization driving conversations to make the world a better, fairer, more delicious place. And we couldn't do it without support from listeners like you. Want to be a part of the food world's most innovative community? Subscribe to the shows you like, tell your friends, and please join the HRN family by becoming a member. Just click on the beating heart at the top right-hand side of our homepage. Thanks for listening.